This is Dr. Richard Barone. I'm continuing my oral history interview with Ron Milam. Ron and I are again in Lubbock, Texas, in the Vietnam Archive interview room on the campus of Texas Tech University. Today is August 23rd, 2005, and it's about 1:25 p.m. Central Standard Time. Ron, we had in our last session we had talked about the ceremony that you went through with becoming a member of this Jirai tribe, and that it was pretty rigorous on the system, and I wanted to kind of get a more of an overlay of that area in which you were operating, and starting with your compound, and you had described it kind of as a horseshoe-shaped compound, and you had kind of detailed already what's in there, but if you could go back through that and lay that out, this is the base from which you will operate.
That's correct. Okay. It was essentially a horseshoe, with the opening of the horseshoe being Highway 14. As my tour started, there was a complete opening on the horseshoe, and later on we would close the horseshoe so that it was almost more of a circle for defensive purposes. And later in my tour, that would have been that was a good thing to do, because we had an incident that attempted overrun through the opening. But the compound was set up. It was really the district headquarters for Phunion District. The districts, there were several districts within Pleiku Province, and the compound on the inside was the organization of the RFPF, Rough Puffs, that would have had their own company commanders and their battalion commanders and all of that kind of an organization. Mm-hmm. We were an advisory team. It was advisory team 36, which was and then within that advisory team there were two what we call MAT teams, mobile advisory teams, and I was the assistant team leader of mobile advisory team 38. The organization, I don't remember if I talked about the organization of the MAT mobile advisory teams, but it was a captain, a lieutenant, two officers, and then a heavy weapons, a light weapons, and a medic on each team. And we were advisors to these rough puffs. In addition, we were advisors to what were called the PSDF, or the People's Self-Defense Forces, which were almost all Montagnards. Mm-hmm. In fact, the PSDF were 100% Montagnards. The Rough Puffs, not necessarily, because they would be whatever organizationally they had going for them in terms of their Vietnamese living in that area. But it was a predominant Montagnard, Jirai, Banar area.
And these individuals, obviously the Rough Puffs would, but the PSDF forces would also live inside the compound?
The PSDF actually lived in the adjacent villages. It was the Rough Puffs with their families who actually had locations on the horseshoe perimeter of the Phunion district headquarters.
Were they specifically put on the perimeter?
Yes, yes. They lived on the perimeter, and their families lived with them on the perimeters. Inside the compound, there was really two different locations, you might say. Inside the compound, you had the commanding, the command post of the Rough Puffs, the district chief. And then you would also had our American advisory team, mm-hmm, right in the center of the whole thing.
Okay.
And we had it was kind of a Quonset hut, reinforced with sandbags, both top and sides and everything else. But it was known to be, it was the military and governmental and civil organization that ran the Phunion district.
Mm-hmm. What was the reason, I want to run through both of the groups that you were advising, what was the reason for putting the Rough Puff families and folks there on the perimeter? Was that specific?
It was to protect the district headquarters. I mean, it was as my year unfolded, in the beginning, I don't recall that we had as much perimeter defense as we did towards the middle of my tour, and certainly towards the end. From the time I got there, and I I guess, early July of 70. It appeared to me, personally, and to the new, and I think in November we had a change of command and got a new district advisor, it appeared that the defense was not sufficient. The 4th Division controlled the Funan District, the Pleiku Province, until October of 1970 when they left. They were completely gone. They started their withdrawal, I believe, in May or June of 1970. By fall of 1970, the intelligence that we were starting to get from NVA probe scout teams, and these were for the last 6 months, I would say, of the 4th Division's tour, most of the enemy contact was with Viet Cong units. By the fall, we were starting to get probes from NVA scout teams. Intelligence was that the NVA ultimately would locate and would centralize their efforts in that region. Once the 4th was out, they would be able to come back in, essentially.
Okay.
And so that intelligence told us that Funan would be a target. I mean, if you know, the history of the Vietnam War is that that area was very sensitive anyway, going back to Plain Me in 65 and every place else. So Funan would be a target. We felt very confident of that. So we started by September of 1970, we started to reinforce everything. The bunker systems, the airfield that we had behind for headhunter activities, for the Cessna 172s that we used for operations, we started to beef up the compound in all respects.
And when you say we, you mean?
Well, the advisors advised the regional forces and the popular forces to begin reinforcements of all of the compound, the backside particularly. The front side didn't seem to be as important because on the front side it essentially abutted up against Highway 14, and there was maybe a 100-yard movement between the road and the and where the compound started. But even there, we started laying minefields.
Was that
horse? It was wide open. Yeah, there was a 90-degree entrance off of Highway 14 coming into our compound, and then there was a large a single wide, I guess you'd call it, trailer that was the living quarters of the district advisor. And my team, immediately, we took upon ourselves as our mobile advisor team to build an elevated bunker on top of that single wide.
Okay.
And we spent 6 months building it in our spare time. Ultimately, it would be one of the things that saved the compound when we almost got overrun. But we started immediately. I mean, in October, it was like as soon as you came in that main drag, you could look up and see the single wide sitting there, and the main man was living in it. And there was no reinforcement other than some low-level sandbags. There was not even anything on top of the trailer, and not even any sandbag top. And it was crazy because we would get mortared a lot, and we had sandbags on top of all of our sleeping quarters. We had them on top of our NCO area. We had them all around everywhere, but we didn't have them on that thing. So we thought, well, if we're going to do this anyway, why don't we just build a first-class fighting bunker, elevated fighting bunker with good fields of fire and everything across it. And so that's what we did.
What were the materials you used?
Sandbags? Sandbags, big, 6x6. We started out with 55-gallon drums. We take our diesel fuel drums as they were empty, and we'd fill those with sand, and we built those up so we had maybe 5 or 6 high of those.
Mm-hmm. This is on top of?
No, these start on the sides, and then when we got to the top, we came up the side, and then we put on top of that, we put 6x6 reinforced, 6x6, yeah, 6x6, coming out of the barrels all the way up, and then we sand, and then we put a tin roof on top of that, and then sandbagged on top of that tin roof, so that we had an elevated fighting bunker.
Yes.
It was terrific. It was a great, great
great thing. Did you all have to get permission to do this? Or when you moved in and you're the American leaders, you essentially are the American leaders.
We were the American leaders. And I was there, I was not, I don't know how long the Mobile Advisory Team 38 had operated in Funan District, and there was another advisory team, and I have forgotten their number right now, but there were two advisory teams and then an advisory, what they call the District Team 36, which was essentially a major, an intelligence officer, an RTO, so there's maybe three or four of them. And then the mobile advisory teams were two teams of five. So we had about 16 total people. How long they had been there until I got there, I don't know. I assume 2 or 3 years. In terms of permission to do what we were doing, I didn't ever ask for permission. I assume that somebody did. I think the major that was in charge, whose single wide we were fixing to protect, probably was happy with it.
Sure.
I assume somebody thought it was an okay idea to put it up there, and because it was a terrific fighting bunker.
And this might seem like a very simplistic question, but how did you know how to build it?
Well, I don't. It's a good question because I don't remember that we sat down and diagrammed it. I think we just finally said, hey, wouldn't it be good to have something there? What if we got around? There was a lumber yard not too far away that was operating, so we could get our 6x6s from them. Mm-hmm. And we just set to do it. And it just seemed that when I got there, it seemed like that was missing. There was not a good fighting location. Whenever we got hit, when we got mortared, we went into defensive positions inside the compound,
right,
which was fine for that kind of an attack. If all you were getting hit with was rockets and mortars. But if you ever had to sustain a ground attack, it would be virtually impossible. We had no place to fight from. We had good areas of observation. We even had right in the middle of the compound, we had our latrine facility and showers. And on top of that, of course, we would have a water blivet that we had to go to the stream and fill every couple of days. And I think it held, 250 or 300 gallons or something. Mm-hmm. And so we had an observation tower associated with that.
Right.
So we could stand up there and look. But we couldn't fight from there because anybody could take a shot at you. There was, and it was in the internal. This thing that we were building was on the
right
external
outside.
Part. Boy, it was right out there. And so we could put a minefield out there. We could put concertina wire out there. And that was kind of closing the horseshoe that I described.
Okay. If you're attacking this and you see this bunker go up, you're observing this, and you, mm-hmm. and you see the mines out. I mean, so you assume this is going to be a very difficult position to really penetrate.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you attack from somewhere else around the other side of the horseshoe?
And they did. Ultimately, they would attack. They would put on a 360-degree attack. And the armor, what there was of it, not much, APC, would come up the road because that's what armor, usually it's easier to just put tanks out that way. And they would come right up the road, and they would put in the best firing position right in front of that bunker. But this bunker was, we used it a lot. I mean, over the year's time, we only had one ground attack in my year. But we used it every time there was from the time that it was completed, every time we were hit with anything, we'd go into that bunker and we'd be able to look out and get a pretty good view of the front as far as the roadway and that sort of thing. It was the rough puffs, though, on the backside that had to protect us from anything on that side. There was also on the I'm describing the horseshoe as the opening would be looking due west, with Highway 14 running north south. The backside on what I would call the south side of the horseshoe, we ultimately put a United States artillery battery. probably, I guess it was a company-sized battery. And so they would become a target also.
So it's shaped, basically, and I'm drawing on the paper here just so that people know directions north, south, east, west.
Highway 14.
14 is running here. Mm-hmm. And
our bunker, the bunker that I've been describing would sit about right there.
Okay.
And the artillery battery ultimately located down here, and their job was to try to protect. Highway 14 was a road that had to be kept open for commerce and everything else between Pleiku and Bamitut. And this artillery battery, it was an American artillery battery, and they were assigned, they were sort of there to protect an engineering battalion that whose responsibility was to keep Highway 14 constructed, first of all, and then secured.
Mm-hmm.
And that is morning mine sweeping, and that's what this is. There was a lot of civilian traffic that ran north and south between Pleiku and Bamitut.
Can you describe the basic dimensions here of this compound?
What is the opening? How it
works? This would probably be, it's probably 200 to 300 yards across here and probably a half a mile back here with a runway back here running parallel to the highway, a dirt runway for the C-172 headhunter units that would come in and help us do scouting.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was a helipad right here for all of our resupply. During the one big contact that we had, this was no longer used. So we had to land inside the compound.
So
and then this was a big open area in here, which was like there were actual buildings, Vietnamese buildings that they used to run the government of Funyan.
Okay. All right. So let me just describe this for people who can't see this. On the opening in the western side of this, you had the helipad was outside of the compound, just outside.
It was just outside of it. Yes.
Was there like a front gate here?
Yes, there was a gate.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So you have a 90-degree off of Highway 14 that comes in. All right. And so where the fighting bunker you all built on top of the single wide was this
on the left side of the highway coming in?
Yes, on the on the south side of the highway, on the south side of the entrance way, the entrance road.
No, it's through. On the north side. This is the artillery compound.
Okay,
so it sits the bunker that I've been describing
sits
right there.
Okay, it sits right there at the gate on the north side of your entrance. And the artillery, was it inside also?
It was outside. They had their own compound essentially.
I see.
With guns aimed. Well, really, their guns were in a situation where they were. This was the road they were protecting. So their guns. The idea being that if they ever had any contact, they would have to protect this area.
Mm-hmm.
But quite frankly, during a lot of the contacts, they were lowered. They were fighting. I mean, they got hit as hard as we did, and they were essentially firing point blank. That's what they used them for.
Right.
And then our building, where we slept, was inside, like, in here. We had a building here, and we had a building here.
And this is inside?
Inside the whole
the large
perimeter. And then this perimeter would be all bunkers.
Okay.
With families, men, women, and children, and with their husband being the soldier.
Mm-hmm.
All the way around.
This is the east side or the back side of the horseshoe?
Yes.
Okay. And your living quarters are in this large open area?
Yeah. We had Quonset hut type things.
What's in the rest of the horseshoe?
It was opened to a certain extent. I'm trying to think. This was outside of the compound. I would say there were buildings. There were a lot of different buildings in this area. Now, what were they for? There was an armory. There was a planning, government offices, and all the political infrastructure was within this whole compound.
when you say buildings, what kind of materials?
They're made out, it's almost like adobe looking stuff. I don't know what their name for it was, but it was what we would think of as being like adobe here.
I'm nodding because I've seen them when I was over there. I've seen these structures. It's not a concrete, it's not clay per se, but it's something in between.
Yes, yes.
Okay. Initially, as an amateur looking at this, and as a civilian looking at this, there's a lot of trust involved between, you know, you guys are mainly focused up toward the opening, towards Highway 14, and you've got, you know, basically your back is to, if you're looking out towards Highway 14, your back is to where the rough puffs.
Absolutely.
I mean, tell me about that relationship. I mean, you said there were 16.
It's also our back is also to what would ultimately be a free fire zone. And virtually everything to I would say 1 to 2 miles off of the of Highway 14, mm-hmm. back east, all the way up to Pleiku, from Funyan to Pleiku, was free fire zone. It was considered that anyone out in that area was VC.
Explain what you just did, but in a little more detail, free fire zones, because that's a point of controversy.
Exactly. The United States government determined that early on, I would say, probably within the first year of operations after March of 65, when ground troops were brought in, the United States government determined that the best way to protect the good guys, if you will, the Vietnamese or the Montagnards who were supporting the South Vietnamese government, mm-hmm. LDR efforts too, would be to move the people from their locations, from their ancestral homes, to more secure areas. That would, by definition, be along highways where the United States and its South Vietnamese allies could protect the people better. So we did that, and part of those efforts were to move the people over to the road. My team was still doing that even in 1970. But a lot of it was done in 67, 68, 69, so this would have been 4th Division efforts to move the people into more secure areas. Now, that, I have some problems with that, for the way that was done in terms of a military decision that was made, but it was done.
Sure.
After they had been moved in that area, the assumption was that anyone who remained was VC or a VC sympathizer. Mm-hmm. It also made it easier if you had the confidence that you had been successful in moving everyone. It made it easy to make decisions about using that area. They called it a free fire zone in the sense that anyone there would be considered to be the enemy. So therefore, you could be more effective with your artillery and your air support. Mm-hmm. You didn't have to worry as much about collateral damage if you wanted to go against a known VC headquarter. Mm-hmm. You didn't have to worry that the local village was so close, because that village should have already been moved to the roadside. So virtually the Funyan back east area that I have described was essentially considered then to be a free fire zone almost all the way up. Now, I can't speak too much beyond the town of Metauk, which was about 10 clicks north of us. From Metauk to the highway to Pleiku, I was pretty much confined to being on the road going to Pleiku. So it really wasn't my AO, it was someone else's. So I don't know, as you get closer to Pleiku, whether that held to be the same, but I believe it was, because I operated in those areas mm-hmm. on the ground, and I also flew it a lot. And I know that when we saw anything moving out there, it was considered to be VC.
Tell me about moving Vietnamese and problems with that from the cultural standpoint, as well as what you said, the military making this decision.
The idea, militarily, I suppose, is sound. That is, our job is to kill BC, and we don't know exactly where they are, but if we can isolate them and say they're out there and none of our people live there, then it makes sense to say that you can do this. The problem with it was that most Montagnards didn't have a strong allegiance to either the VC or certainly not to the South Vietnamese government. Montagnards themselves, I think, were very supportive of Americans because I think Americans historically had supported them in their efforts against the Vietnamese, whether they be North or South. But the problem was in saying, okay, we're going to move you. We would move them from their location to the roadside, and we'd try to set up a new village. But those people had lived in their old area for thousands of years. Grandpa was buried there. The people didn't want to move to a more secure place. They would take their chances out there. And so they go back. So we'd move them in. Well, the first thing that has to happen is you have to move them to a location. Then you have to build them homes. Have them the houses. So we had this very elaborate program of USAID who would come in, and they would bring in these big sheets of big truckloads of tin, and they build these tin roofed hooches, which in some ways were not as comfortable as the thatch roofs that they had built out there.
Right.
But it was quicker to do it that way. So you had this whole process, and then they had to start life all over again, living right there on the highway. Well, the highway didn't bring anything to them. They were rice farmers, and their rice fields were out there. Now all of a sudden they had to grow rice within 50 yards of the highway. And they didn't go into Pleiku and conduct commerce. That's not what they did. So they had no desire to go to Bami Tuit to the south or to Pleiku. Yes, it was more convenient and comfortable for us to secure them there than it was to secure them two or three or five or six clicks in. It was a failure, in my opinion, and it made no sense. My own opinion is that the better way for us to have done it would have been to try to secure them out there. Now, that's what the Marines tried to do with the CAP teams in I Corps.
Right.
We were not as successful in doing that as an Army, I don't believe, as the Marines were with their CAP teams.
How much of this, and I'm addressing more the historian in you, was based on successes by other countries in Southeast Asia or elsewhere, such as Sir Thompson and Malaysia?
Yeah, Thompson in Malaysia was the example that Colby and Comer and others, I believe, I'm trying to think here, who all was involved in the very beginning in the 1962 Strategic Hamlet concepts.
Lansdale was part of that.
Yeah, Lansdale. The problem, I believe, is that if you study the British Malaysian experience, they had a built-in ethnic hatred between the Chinese supporters at the communist side and the Malaysians, so it was easier to do there than you had in Vietnam, where particularly in the Central Highlands, where the Montagnards, yeah, they hated the Vietnamese, but they didn't. It wasn't a matter of saying, "Oh, I'm going to like it over here better, therefore, come on, move me."
Mm-hmm.
It's still a matter of you can't duplicate what people have done for thousands of years, and if warfare has been part of living anyway, then the risk is, okay, if I stay out there, I might die at the hands of either American bombs or DC. But if you move me, I'll be miserable. So I think I'd rather stay.
Mm-hmm.
And so we would build these new places. We'd move the people to the... We didn't go to nearly the extent that the strategic hamlets did with the concertina wire and the moats and the whole nine yards like that. And that was a failure, too.
Mm-hmm.
But we did move them so that we could secure them. And then a month later, we'd be out there saying, where'd the village go? And they would have moved back. And every inhabitant in this place was gone. And then we'd have to worry if they're back there, and then we had to make sure we called off any artillery strikes that were going to be in the area. It was a mess. It was a mess.
And this is in 1970.
70, yes. We should have known better. And I would say this. We were still trying to do it without a 4th Division, without an operating infantry unit that could go out and secure these villages anyway, out there or here or anywhere else.
Right.
We were 15 Americans. So it was, I don't consider it to have been a success. On the other hand, I would say that what we did on a daily basis, where we went into the villages that were already located along Highway 14, certainly Funyan, Metauk, Plagiarang on the south, and other names that I have forgotten, up and down the highway, those villages were pretty secure and pretty pacified, to use that word.
Mm-hmm.
And I measured them that way. We had a very elaborate measurement process for determining whether the district was pacified. Or whether the village was pacified. And I think reasonably so, along with previously established villages.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of trying to be successful in building new ones, I don't think we did a very good job. I was going back and looking at some of my old video, some of my old Super 8s that I shot of these movements. And I shot a lot of the movements, bringing the people in. It showed us building the new places and us out serving soup in the rain so that these people could get their new buildings up, and the chickens, bringing their chickens in and their pigs and everything. And they don't look real happy. We as Americans look reasonably satisfied, but the Montagnards that are being moved don't look real happy. I don't know whether that's me, you know, telepathically looking at it or not, but as I look back, the video is kind of describing faces that, in retrospect, when I think about it, were not very happy faces.
And just for the record, you are going to, for people listening, you're going to donate this stuff. So it's going to be here.
Yes.
So people will be able to see these films.
They will be able to see them. The process, as I understand it, is going to be that I'm going to donate all the original Super 8s. They're going to be... they're going to be streamed for me first, and then I will provide captioning on them, maybe narration, I don't know yet, and then they should be accessible to anybody.
Yes. Okay. So people listening to this years from now can go check these out.
Yes. Soon
they'll be ready years from now. Tell me about the Montagnards as almost a fourth or fifth force inside this war. You've got the North and South Vietnamese, you have the Americans, and you have the kind of observant and sometimes participatory, you know, other countries. You've got the Australians and Zealanders and the South Koreans, you have the Chinese and the Soviets on the other side. So you've got this international component to it. But then you've got the Montagnards thrown in there as well, that are their allegiance is, you know, first and foremost to themselves and to their family, their village, and that land.
Mm-hmm.
Then maybe, like you said, to the Americans or those who are to the, how does that play, or how did that complicate the effort?
It complicated it to a significant degree. The Montagnards were the indigenous peoples. There's been studies done and a lot written about that the Montagnards were the Native Americans of Vietnam, and the Vietnamese were the Chinese that came down. And I'm not enough of an anthropologist in terms of that to be able to speak as an expert on it, but I can say that the Montagnards themselves did not consider themselves to be part of the Vietnamese culture in any way. They had their own culture. They had, I suppose, some of them had fought with the French, some had fought against the French, depending on, you know, the geopolitical issues at that moment. Mm-hmm. But the Montagnards themselves were a very private, quiet people whose interests as a people were in the preservation of their own culture and in the most basic ways of life. Rice farming, lumbering. They were, and they did not particularly believe that they had been treated well by the Vietnamese. Americans tended, and my impression was that going back to the very earliest days of American involvement in the early 60s. That when the United States put the special forces camps in along the Cambodian-Laotian border, the United States tended to sympathize for whatever reason. Part of my future hope to study this, because I still don't understand it completely. But my observations at the time were that the American soldier liked the Vietnamese, the Montagnard soldier, and vice versa. They had an allegiance to Americans that I did not see with the Vietnamese, generally speaking.
How did you see it? What were the marks of this?
I suppose in combat, as much as anything, watching them as warriors with very crude instruments, as I think I described in my last our last meeting. Very crude instruments, World War II instruments that we gave them. They were better with their World War II instruments, and they stayed with it more so in some ways than the Vietnamese mm-hmm. did with their M16s. Maybe it was because they truly were protecting the homeland. Protecting your village, where a lot of the rough puffs were, maybe their family lived in Pleiku, maybe their family lived down in Bemituat, and the rough puffs themselves, although there were elements, there certainly would have been mountain yards that were part of the rough puffs, that were more of a soldier. But those that were given, mostly the PSDF, that were given the responsibility of protecting the village, did. And they did a pretty good job of protecting it against BC, because that was the controlling, that was predominantly what was controlled in that area. Now, would it have been the same if it had been an NVA area and if they had been trying to keep South Vietnamese or Americans out? I think that's a good question, and I don't have a lot of experience with that because that wasn't the case in the Phu Nhon district. Mm-hmm. Very loyal. Didn't particularly like the Arvin district chief, but liked the American advisor to the Arvin district chief. Was it the American's feeling for the underdog? I don't know. But there was something about that relationship that has stayed with us even to this day. I'm sure you're aware of the efforts in North Carolina with some of the old Special Forces guys to save the Montagnard movement and this sort of thing. And that's a very positive thing. We have some of their students here. But it's something that I think needs to be studied because yet at the same time, it was the Central Highlands. It was Bemituat that fell first in 1975.
Mm-hmm. Were these observations that you were able to make then and there, or is this more reflection?
Well, it's a good question, and if you'd asked me this 6 weeks ago, I may have said it's more reflection than it was observation that I made. But in the process of this going back and looking at all of my letters and everything to make this move to Lubbock, Texas, I went back and read some of my letters, and I was making those observations then. It was almost scary because those memories have stayed with me, and I've wondered whether I formed them now that I've studied the war for academically for 6 years. But I wrote those things home to my wife. Mm-hmm. I made it very clear who I thought the winners and losers were, who the good guys and the bad guys were, who was doing getting it done and who wasn't. Mm-hmm. Very clear in my letters that I thought the Montagnards were terrific people who were doing everything they could to protect themselves. And I didn't feel the same way about the Vietnamese. If anything, my attitude towards the Arvin, as I've read about them in other places since then, as a historian, my attitude towards the Arvin has improved beyond what I was observing 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm. How much, looking back, let me ask this more generally. When Vietnam veterans who were exposed to the Montagnards and Arvin and anyone kind of caught in between on that fringe area, mm-hmm. geographically and socially, how do they, you or them, the veterans in general, how do they come to an understanding of who they were fighting for and who they were fighting with? Because you hear, or I hear in doing these interviews, so much negativity about Arvin, then you do hear nuggets of, you know, they were really good. My experience was a positive one with them. You hear a lot of more positive things about the Montagnards, as you're saying here. And then people caught in the middle, and some veterans put those who've been interviewed and talk about this, put the Viet Cong in the middle, kind of also mm-hmm. as a
right.
outsider, kind of in between society. Reflecting, and then, was there a confusion about who you were allied with?
There certainly was then. I think historically, we all get caught up in everything that we've read and everything that we've heard and what we've talked to our buddies who fought in another area. As I'm sure you know from all your oral histories that you've done, every soldier's experiences in Vietnam was different because the country was very large and areas of operation were different and problems were different. And if you were in an American unit, you have one opinion, and if you were in an advisor, you have another one. I tend to discount a lot of the comments that a lot of American veterans make about the Arvin, because many of them didn't have anything to do with the Arvin. They were assigned to the 4th Division, and the 4th Division was out in operations, and they hardly ever even saw an Arvin. In my own research, and my own oral histories that I've done, and in my own questionnaires that I sent out, so many soldiers who were combat experienced, I would say in my questionnaire, I'd say, tell me about your experiences with the Arvin. And they'd say, I didn't have much experience with them, but they weren't any good. Well, I think the first statement tells you a lot about what they say at the end of the statement. Mm-hmm. Now, as an advisor, I did have experiences with both.
Right.
I thought the Arvin were lacking in field-grade leadership. I think they were lacking in general grade leadership, but I don't have first-hand knowledge of that mm-hmm. because that's more what I have read, what I heard, but I didn't associate with them. But I've read enough about them that leads me to believe there were some leadership gaps. Field grade, same thing. Company grade. Junior officers and NCOs that the Arvin that I fought with were pretty good. I don't have anything generally to say bad about. I never saw them run from a fight. Mm-hmm. I saw them stay and fight. I didn't think that the relationship between them and the Montagnards in these Montagnard districts was a very good one. In other words, I saw them looked down upon. Now, we tried to have a Thanksgiving and Christmas. We invited both the Montagnards and the village chiefs in and the Vietnamese, and they appeared to get along okay. But the respect was lacking. The Arvin didn't respect the Montagnards, and the Montagnards saw the Vietnamese as being in an area they shouldn't be. And the leadership positions, the Arvin were not prone to bring Montagnard people into leadership positions within the military. So most of the most of the NCOs and company grade officers supervising Montagnard soldiers were Vietnamese. Now, certainly you can say, well, who am I to make that judgment when my own army was white company company commanders supervising black soldiers? So yeah, we have the same kinds of ethnic issues within our own military. So I have to at least keep that in mind as I say what I just said.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that we probably have been too critical of the actual soldier himself. I think the Vietnamese soldier did a pretty good job trying to win in a difficult situation. I think that the Vietnamese soldier out on the ground during combat situations tried his best, but I don't think that the field grade leadership was as good as it should have been. Now, I can say the same thing about some of the field grade leadership in America.
Right.
And since I wasn't part of an American unit, most of that is stuff I've read, mm-hmm. more so than it is anything else.
Mm-hmm. When you arrived out there, you did go through, I remember you saying that you went through a kind of a learning period where the person whom you replaced didn't leave immediately.
Right.
They stayed on, what, I think for 2 weeks or so?
Yes, about that. Mm-hmm.
Was that adequate for you, do you feel?
I think so. With the other training that I had, I was pretty comfortable weapons-wise. It was more a matter of where things are. And in some ways, it was maybe better that he left when he did, because he was a short-timer, and he had an attitude, as most people do, and it probably was best that I begin fresh. Mm-hmm. So I think it was adequate.
What was your attitude when you arrived?
I was excited. I was ready to win that war. I was ready to... I certainly had been part of all of the, you know, anti-war movement on the college campuses. I'd come right out of college, and mm-hmm. you know, before I went in the Army, so I was, I guess, a year. I guess I was 2 years since I had graduated from college when I got to Vietnam. But I paid a lot of attention to all the reasons that people felt like we shouldn't be there. Once I got there, I guess I sort of forgot all that and was of the opinion, in some ways, my role was almost mercenary, in the sense that I was advising a people who I could on a daily basis see were getting screwed by the NVA. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was a matter of, these are the good guys, these are the ones that I'm here to teach, show how to protect themselves against the bad guys, the NVA and the VC. And I was willing to accept that. And I never changed my mind about that as I was there.
How identifiable were the VC? How easy? Because you hear, you know, you couldn't tell your enemy from your friend.
Well,
how could you?
They were very easy to identify when they were dead. It's kind of flippant, but that's about the best I can come up with.
I've heard that before.
Because there was no other way to identify them when they were alive.
It was either when you saw them in the attack, you could say, okay, those are the Viet Cong, or they're dead.
And it doesn't make any difference if they're Viet Cong or not, they're shooting at me. So therefore, I assume they're the bad guys. And that's what I'm here to do. That's a defensive situation. But even when you would go into the village, we had some situations, and this is where it gets a little crazy. We had some situations. We had Chu Hoys. And for the purpose here, the Chu Hoy was essentially like a Kit Carson scout. It was someone who had been a VC at one time, and he had come over to our side.
Right.
And we used him for intelligence. We used him as a guide in many areas. And so I always wondered about them. And I had a lot of them that were really good friends, became guys that I trusted. But I never knew for sure. And we had a couple of situations where we got called in the morning. We got a call from the village through the channels of communications that we had set up into the district. District chief would come in and say that such and such a village was hit last night. and we need to go out there. So we'd get in our Jeeps and we'd drive out there, and there'd be three VC bodies there, and one of them would be somebody I knew. And it's like, whoa.
Knew from...
Yeah, I knew him personally. He was somebody that we had trusted, somebody that we had thought was giving us good information, and at night he had been part of an attack on that village. The PSDF had held their own and taken these guys out, and there they were.
And what do you do inside?
Well, yeah, I think the first time it happened, I can remember three different occasions that it happened, and I think the first time it was really a shock, and by the third time it wasn't. It was just part of it, you know. So then you start wondering who you can trust. On the other hand, all you've got is their intelligence.
Right.
So you have to run with it, you know. It wasn't a situation where my life was in danger, but that village was. And of course, the village chief, as they're pointing down and going through this whole thing with the body, would make all these claims about, I knew it all along, I knew this guy, we shouldn't trust him, blah, blah, blah. He would have brought our whole village down. And of course, and part of it was their being proud of what they had just done.
Sure. Not losing face.
Oh, yeah. And I can remember going out on a couple of night ambush patrols, and we would go out not too far from, it was the scariest, I think the hardest thing that you do as an infantry soldier is a night ambush.
I do want you to talk about that in detail, and how not necessarily your fear in detail, you can't mm-hmm. want to, and I will ask you about that, but I do want you to describe exactly the operations you guys would do at night, and how you would set a night ambush, and
mm-hmm. Part of it, I think, was directed to us by the major in charge, our district advisor. We were probably responsible to do, you know, one a month or one a week, or, you know, somebody that worked for him to, you know, he could report it and stuff. That's my guess. Mm-hmm. That's my cynicism showing here. Because at times we'd say, why are we doing this? But we picked the location. And we'd say, okay, let's go out. We think that the last attack that came in on this particular village came in from the west.
How many days after? A couple days ago?
Yeah, 2 days ago. Okay. It would be reasonably... generally speaking, what we would do is if there was an attack on a village, we would go out the next morning, we would call up, and we had real good support from these, what we call the headhunters. And the headhunters were American Army pilots who flew Cessna 172s out of Pleiku, out of Camp Holloway, which was the area that was supported the 4th Division, but it was still there after the 4th had left. And these guys would fly down in their Cessna 172 and land at our little landing strip behind there, and I'd go out and get in. And myself or the other MAT team guy would get in, and we'd fly that area and see if we could see anything. Any areas of ingress into the village that looked suspicious to us.
You mean what?
Oh, smoke. Small. We'd get down low enough to where we could see campgrounds. If it looked like there had been any bivouac the night before. Little small fires, clearings, anything. You're looking for big things, but you're not finding. I don't know that we ever found anything big,
right.
But we're looking for something. So we might say, okay, then what we need to do is if this happened now, it might happen again. Let's set up a night ambush on these particular areas of ingress. So we would go out. I'd land, and then I'd get a PSDF unit together from the local village.
How would you do that?
I would go into the village and I would talk to the village chief. And I'd say, your local PS, because we trained all these guys.
So they knew you?
Oh yeah, they knew us. They knew us well. And I'd say, okay, let's go out tonight, 5 o'clock, 1700 hours, let's go out. We'd usually go out early. That might be a little early, maybe 1900 hours, because we'd want to get out. We'd want to go out in daylight and then set up. So we would go out, and of course, you know, you would. And, well, first of all, I would sit down between the time that I went out on my reconnaissance. I would sit down, and I would plot on a map exactly where we were going to set up the ambush.
How Okay, go ahead. And then you'd go to the bill. Then you'd go.
Yeah. I'd have all this pre-planned, and then I'd go to the bill. But I would sit out. I would plan it on a map. I would plan the march out, and then I would preset artillery fire at certain locations. And I would walk that over. If I was using these guys, they were almost organic for us, even though they weren't designed like the ones that I showed you on the map. Mm-hmm. They weren't really designed to be our organic artillery, but we could use them. So I would plot out artillery fire. We didn't have any mortar units, so there wasn't anything like that. We had M79s, but we didn't have. So I would plan that. I would also plan flares. And I would tell these guys that I'm going to, at certain sounds, because we go into communication silence a lot at night, two clicks would mean a flare, and so we could get a flare up if we saw anything. And so we would have all that planned, and that would be on our trip out, and then I'd also have it planned if we had an attack, if we had an ambush, we would have to have an area of retreat. And as we were retreating back, I would have pre-planned fire like every 300 meters through these particular blocks. All set up so you don't have to do any thinking. You know exactly where you are. You've set your ambush location for the exact place. So if you get hit at night, if you have an ambush on your retreat, you could just be lighting them up with artillery. And so that was all done ahead of time. So then you'd get your guys, you'd go out about 1900 hours. And
how much time, I'm sorry to interrupt mm-hmm. you, how much time from when you went in, after you planned it, you handed off your coordinates and stuff to the artillery, then you go to the village?
And I go to the village. We may have sent somebody, one of my guys may have gone out that afternoon and told them what we're going to do. Everybody get together at 1900 hours. And what you may be thinking is, how long did it take in terms of getting the word to the VC? And I always wondered about that myself.
Yes. So, well, there's two items there. One, how much lead time did you have to give the Rough Puffs to kind of to get ready?
Yeah. You know, I think we gave them a lot of time. I don't remember ever being concerned that if we wait and tell them an hour ahead of time, maybe they won't tell the VC. I don't remember that being an issue. I think probably what happened is over time, it just became routine. And it got to the point where you were torn between accepting the fact that the VC are going to know it, and maybe we'll surprise them, and maybe we won't. And if we surprise them, that's a bad thing, because that means that we're going to have a real enemy contact. I would like to say that I worried about it, but I don't remember worrying about it. I don't remember. I think it just became part of the job, and part of you accepted the fact that the intelligence would get out there. Yeah.
But they wouldn't necessarily know exactly where.
They wouldn't know exactly where. And you wanted a kill. You wanted some kills. You wanted some success. I don't ever remember thinking, though, oh boy, I hope we have an enemy contact tonight. If it happens, it happens. We're ready for it. These guys are good. My PSDFs are pretty good soldiers. I'd always take out, and the thing is, we'd usually just two Americans, and then the rest would be PSDF. And I'm describing a PSDF ambush thing. I'm not describing some Rough Puff operation,
right,
which is different than that. Usually we didn't take the Rough Puffs out at night. We took them out on day operations. But night operations was almost always the boys in the loincloths.
I assume that's because they were better. They knew the area.
Oh, I had a complete confidence in them. They knew the area, and I figured that they knew that we were protecting their village.
Right.
Particularly if there had been a contact tonight before and they'd lost a couple of people. They want to get these guys, right? So we'd go out, and so we would take, because of two Americans, I'd always take, their weapons, as I described last week, were, you know, the 45 caliber Thompson submachine gun and the Browning automatic rifle. Well, I wanted a little more firepower than that, so we had we took some M79s, and we took an M60. I always took an M60 out.
Right.
Took some Claymores, and they were not given Claymores as their part of their normal operation, so we always took Claymore mines out. And we took the trip wires, and we would set up a, you know, either a horseshoe or sometimes we'd do a horseshoe, but most of the time we would do a not a horseshoe. We would set up an L shape here and here. Almost always L shape, but sometimes, depending on if you could get a situation where I've forgotten all my military terms now, but if you could get a situation where you had a point of ending, almost like a cul-de-sac kind of a thing, that you could ward off that way, then you could just line up on this side. And so that's what we would do most of the time. We'd be at like cross here and hoping that the point would come down, they'd come through here, and then we'd get them this way. So we're describing a very simple operation.
You'll end up on a trail?
On a trail. Just off a trail.
Right.
The Viet Cong were, just like us, trying to stay off the trails, but you can't really avoid it in the really thick jungles and around the Central Highlands. They were pretty thick. So you almost had to use trails. We set up some very crude booby traps. We didn't dig pits and do all that kind of stuff, but we had the claymores set up. And the claymores would be command detonated.
Mm-hmm.
And
who had command of those?
Usually I would have those be with one of my, usually I'd have an NCO with me, and I'd have him have a couple of them wired together with one squeeze mechanism, and then usually whoever the senior PSDF guy was, we would have him lined up with it, and we would and then you'd wait, and you know, you supposedly you would do we would go out to the village. And then at just as darkness is starting to set in, we'd start our movement. We wouldn't really wait to go out in complete cover of darkness. My fear was always booby traps that had already been set up, and you couldn't see them as well in darkness. So we would go out at when you could still see what's going on.
When you all would set out on foot, where were you in this column?
Was it a column? Right in the middle.
Okay.
With my RTO.
Okay. And you're carrying what? Describe to me what you have on your person.
I'm wearing a 38 Smith & Wesson that was not assigned to me. We were 45s. I bought that one from one of the guys that had left the year before in a nice handmade holster that I had made in the village. With tea candles that I had made myself, or I had made and I carved them and put them on myself.
Oh.
And well blued. That was my personal weapon. Then I carried an AR-15, which I had also gotten from an Air Force guy, from an Air Force pilot, because we weren't authorized to have those.
Mm-hmm.
AR-15, we call them Car 15s, so I don't know, remember exactly, but it was a very short stock M16. With a folding stock,
mm-hmm.
essentially, and it could be, you know, put down to a very small size. So I was carrying that with we didn't have banana clips. We had, but we had we would tape two 20 round magazines, and we would put 18 rounds in them, and then we would tape them together so that I had 36 rounds, could invert it up. So I was carrying that as my other. As my weapon, and no ruck, because I'm only be out there at night.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wearing a magazine shirt that I had made in the village, where I could slip all these magazines in it. I carried a I don't think I even carried an ammo pouch. I may have carried an ammo pouch. I carried morphine tubes. I didn't usually take my medic out on something like that. He wasn't a real good fighter, so I figured that he wouldn't come in handy. So I carried my own morphine, and then had our RTO with me, and he usually carried an M79. So we had that extra additional firepower if we needed it.
Was that his personal choice, or did you say, I want you to take the M79?
Yeah, exactly. Someone's got to carry it, you carry it. And then we'd give an M60 usually to one of the mountain yards, and they love that. We set that up on a tripod, of course, across the thing. And then the mountain yards pretty much carried their own weapons. I mean, I don't mean crossbows.
Right.
But they carried what we had trained them on. A lot of Thompson's submachine guns with 4-1 tracers. We'd have a couple of BARs. I wasn't real keen on the Stevens shotgun, single shot shotgun. Now, you had not a lot of firepower with that.
Right.
They hunted birds mostly with those. And then a few M1 carbines from World War II. And I, in fact, I had one of those myself that I used as a lap gun. And I cut the stock off, and I just had a little handle on it like that. And I used that. I called that my lap gun because when we'd run the highways, I would carry that on my lap. It was a nice small thing to have right here.
You're really well armed.
Pretty well armed, but again, the guys that you're fighting against are going to all be carrying AK-47s.
Right.
And I don't know if we were sufficiently armed to take them on ambush situation.
But you were the one springing the ambush.
We were springing the ambush, and we had the artillery. Quite frankly, it would be the artillery that would make the difference, because if we sprung an ambush, we'd be out of there quick. And our area of egress was pre-plotted. And if they were chasing us, which hopefully they wouldn't be because we had been successful, we would be bringing the world on top of them with that artillery. And our area of egress would be well protected. My guess is there would never have been a situation where they chased us on our way out.
Did they?
We only, in what I have just described to you, we only sprung one ambush. The victim was a leopard. And I had remembered this, and I took pictures of it and everything.
Okay.
But it came back in time because it was in a letter to my wife.
Okay.
I wrote back to her telling her about this leopard ambush.
So all the times you went out on ambush, you only swung it once on this.
Yes, and we got a leopard.
How many times do you think you went out on ambush?
I'm going to guess I didn't go out more than once a month on a night ambush. So that maybe ten times in my whole tour. Yeah. Now, yes.
Okay.
The only ambush I was ever involved in with an enemy was I was on the receiving end.
Nighttime or
daytime?
Daytime. Was it a problem of the VC knowing where you guys are going to be setting up the whole deal? What, even your
you
your
know
area?
I believe so, because when I think of all the night ambushes that you know, say if I did it 10 times, but yep, we probably did 40
right
of them as a responsibility of our district group, I don't remember that we ever were successful, that we ever killed anybody on a night ambush. We were the victims more than we were the victims on the highway a lot. I was ambushed on the highway several times, ambushed once on a day operation. So my guess is that the intelligence network of the VC was pretty sufficient, and if they knew they were outnumbered at night, they didn't mess with us.
How do they know if they were outnumbered?
I'm guessing that they knew everything. I'm guessing that they knew all about how many men we typically took out.
Which was?
Two Americans and 22, maybe 22, maybe half a platoon, maybe, you know, what would that be, two and a half squads, something like that. It wasn't quite as organized as an American unit, so I think I remember going out with 20 to 25 men. I mean, that's a good size unit, but you wouldn't be able to stand up to AK-47s sufficiently if they had the same number. I think they also knew about the artillery, and they knew that we could bring the world in. And we never had a night contact other than this one leopard thing.
Did you think about it at the time? Like,
oh, yeah. I was scared every night. I was scared shit. I was scared all the time when I went out on a night ambush.
Well, did you think about the fact that, wait a minute, we're not making a lot of contact here. This is not making sense.
I think I thought more along the lines of, we got back in, it was successful because nobody got hurt.
All right.
And maybe the fact that we did it kept this village safe that night.
Okay. Couple questions then.
Yeah.
The first one, again, might sound simplistic, but what was the point of the ambush? The American ambush.
The ambush, the point was that, well, for one thing, you know, we could report that we did it.
Right.
That meant we were working, doing our job.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, I think that if the village was hit last night and we could get out within 2 days, then we might be successful. I guess it's kind of like fishing. There are men who fish, and there are men who never catch the marlin, but they still go fishing. We, looking at it from the standpoint of what can we do, we can do this. These people are trained. They could do it without us, but there's more likely, and will be more likely successful with us, because if they do it without us, they don't have the artillery support that they're going to need. We might get a body count out of it. If we do catch that same unit coming back in, or something like that unit, and we're able to take them out, then we'll get a body count, and we may get a big body count because with all this artillery. But you're right. I mean, if I did it 10 times and never was successful, would I have been successful if I'd done it 20 times? We usually did not do it without there having been an incident of some kind. So we didn't just say, let's go out and do an ambush. We did it because something had happened. So I guess from a positive standpoint, you'd say, yeah, well, maybe we kept that village from getting hit that next night. And maybe they knew that we might be out there on ambush, so therefore they let that village alone.
Why were you all more reactive versus proactive?
Well, that's a very good question that gets to the whole issue of the way we conducted the war.
Right.
As you probably know, most studies have shown that 70% of all contacts with the NVA or the VC were initiated by them, not by the Americans. Mm-hmm. We were defensive. We were reactive. I think probably just because we were outnumbered, we were small, we only had, you know, 15 of us. They, on their own, may have done more, but our involvement was that we participated more on a reactive basis.
What defines success in an ambush, besides Ron getting back and your RTO getting back safe and sound?
Yeah, I'm afraid I might say that that's the number one thing. Other than that, I think the success would be in watching the men perform, watching whether they maneuvered properly on patrol,
mm-hmm.
whether they kept radio silence, whether they kept their own silence, whether they conducted themselves as I knew they were capable of doing, whether they seemed to have their heart in it, whether they seemed to be afraid or scared. In a lot of ways, by number 8 or 9, there was a lot of nonchalance on their part. Not on my part.
Right.
But on their part.
Why? They just said,
I don't know. I think that just doing it again, and maybe it's the old thing that... I'm reminded, it just occurred to me, I'm reminded of when I used to coach T-ball.
Uh-huh.
And I'm reminded of being out in center field, and my little center field T-baller was sitting there, or standing out there with his glove on his head. And I said to him, Johnny, you better take that glove off your head and put it on your hand. They may hit a ball out here. And he said, Mr. Milam, I've been out here all summer, and nobody has ever been out here. And I think there is something to that.
I'm laughing. I mean, he does have a great point. I heard the same thing this
last
summer.
Yeah, because the real good players are playing shortstop and first base and pitcher, right? Or on the pitcher's mound, mm-hmm. I guess, in T-ball. They're not in center field. And the kid is in center field because he... puts his glove on his head.
Right.
So anyway, I hate to laugh and make that comparison, but it's kind of like that. I think in a lot of cases, these soldiers, these PFDS soldiers who were good soldiers, may have seen a little bit of folly in it. And why are we doing this? And like I say, we got that leopard. Boy, we got him good. And that was like the most excitement that we'd had on a night ambush.
What'd you do with the leopard?
They skinned it, and I assume they ate it. They dressed it beautifully, put it on a stick, and carried it back into the village. I got some great pictures of it. Just amazing. It was a beautiful leopard. I mean, it was a beautiful leopard from an American viewpoint of what I've seen in a zoo. Mm-hmm. Good size. It had been wounded earlier by somebody taking a shot at it. We'd heard some shots early at night, and I think it came back. I think it was already, but they lit it up. They lit it up with M60.
Oh gosh.
Oh gee, they just really put it to it.
Okay, I'm not laughing either.
Yeah,
to make light of the situation, and I'm certainly not. Obviously, passing judgment on the tactics or the strategy mm-hmm. here. I'm just curious, from someone who went through it, you know, what you saw, what you felt.
Yeah.
Again, simplistic question with probably a very deep answer. Why were you scared shitless?
You feel totally at the mercy of an enemy who knows where he is and is comfortable in the jungle compared to me personally. I've lived in a jungle. I'm a city boy. I'm not a gun person. I got pretty good at what I did. And in an ambush, supposedly, you know where you are and he doesn't know where he is, therefore, you have the advantage. But it's dark. It's night. I also, in the great army's wisdom, put an infantry officer in me who had poor night vision. I almost didn't get in the army at all because my night vision was so bad. So I wasn't someone who saw real good at night anyway.
You knew this going on.
Oh yeah, I knew it. And so I had to do things like pre-plan my flares. Oh, flare was the best thing in the world for me because I could put one of those on top and look out and see everything. But that night stuff, seeing in pure dark. Now, some people used to kid me about that, saying, "Well, you're not scared at night because you can't see anything." You know, I mean, I couldn't. I'm not like some people. Everything I saw, I thought was the enemy. No, I couldn't see much. I just, to this day, I don't have great night vision. So that was, I think, an issue also, is I never felt real comfortable there. I had great I had strong feelings for the quality of my men, the Montagnards, but I didn't know how they would react in a real situation. You can practice all you want, you know, on a range or any, but you know when the trip flare goes off and the first claymore is fired, man, that leopard was a perfect example. If it was, you know, one leopard, we got him good, but he couldn't fight back. I don't know how we would have done if it had been more than one man. What if it? I had 25 men. What if it was a company? Mm-hmm. What if it was the scout team of a company? That's what I always feared, is I might get, you know, we might be successful getting the first 7 or 8. But if there's 150 behind them and we're fleeing, we've got our egress planned, and then I'm going to drop the world in on top of them with all this artillery. But what if there really is 150 of them and we don't get out? And so, I mean, ambush is tough. Ambush is really tough. And the other thing is, in American units, most of the time, lieutenants, officers don't go out on ambush. That's what squads do. That's what NCOs do. That's what sergeants do. The lieutenant stays back. I was a lieutenant. I wasn't acting like a lieutenant on an ambush patrol. I was just another soldier out there. Mm-hmm. So I didn't like night ambushes. That was, to me, the worst. The The things that I was always most scared of in Vietnam were landmines on the highway. I was never afraid of the first, if I could not be hit by the first mortars that fell, I always felt like I could get to safety before they would adjust. So mortars were not that scary to me. Mm-hmm. Rockets were never scary because rockets were so inaccurate. They just didn't know where they were going, sort of thing. But the thing that scared me the most were landmines and night ambushes. I just didn't like those.
How dark would it get?
Well, you know, depending on the moon, there were no lights in the area, so, you know, if the moon was full, it wouldn't be very dark. If the moon was not full, pretty dark.
Did you want it to be... it's a loaded question. Did you want it to be dark, or did you want a full moon?
With my poor night vision, I think I wanted all the light I could get. Even understanding that your success is probably going to be less on a night like that because they could, you know, they're not going to be out necessarily. I like to see. I like to see. I never conducted a day ambush. Was ambushed during the day, as I told you, but never. So we didn't even think about doing it. It was a night because that's when the VC were out. That's when, you know, you're not going to get them in the daytime. You can get them at night. So, you know, look in a book and say, let's put it on night ambushes. And we could. And I always felt good when I got in. We were all survived. I would, you know, write my after-action report up. The Leopard one was great, I'm sure. I'd have to, go to the archives and read that one. I'm sure it's out there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I didn't like night ambushes.
What do you see right now when you think about that night ambush? What do you see in your mind's eye?
I remember the Leopard one in particularly, but I also remember my last one. Because my last one took place about 3 weeks before I came home, in a time that I felt like I shouldn't be going out on night ambush. It also took place after the siege of Funyan and the NVA were in the area, and we knew that. So I was really scared that night. And I remember thinking that this might be it, you know, if we do have it, and we took out extra men and all those kinds of things. But, you know, since I'd never been in one, didn't know how we would do, that one scared me a lot more because I knew in 3 weeks I wouldn't have to ever do another night ambush.
Right. Describe to me, before we stop for today, after you go out, you describe the lead up during the day of kind of planning the thing, and then you head out right there at dusk when mm-hmm. night is falling, but you can still see. How far out would you go? How you would go in column? Mm-hmm. Who was on point? Things like that.
Yeah. There was always some PSDF soldier who would volunteer to walk point. I never ever remember saying having to force someone. You always, my attitude, and I wasn't an American unit, so I don't know how the Americans done it, but I've read enough about it. I always believe that you want your best man on point.
Yes.
And I think American units did that. That's why I don't ever buy into, you know, the issue of black men walk point more than white guys because white guys didn't mind black guys dying. Well, you want your best. You want your best. Native American Indians were the best. They had comfort in the, or guys from Tennessee, or, you know, guys that had been hunters all their life. They just had a feel for the woods, in this case the jungle. So you put your best man out there. So there was always somebody that would want to walk point. So we put him out there. Then we'd have the column, as it came back, we would try to disperse the weapons so that we had a BAR up front, as much as we could get one up front there. I would always throw, like I said, my RTO carried an M79, so I always had him there next to me. And then I walked in the middle, as middle as I could get. And I never wore insignia. And I very seldom wore jungle fatigues. We had I had camouflage fatigues made in the village for me that were real skin tight, so they didn't brush against anything, and no names or anything on it.
What kind of hat?
I wore a a boonie cap, as they call it. It was essentially a floppy with a chin strap underneath it, and I had a camouflage one, and then I had just a plain green one. And never a helmet. I didn't wear a helmet in Vietnam. Trying to think, I had one. It was issued one. And I don't believe I ever even put it on when I went out, when we got hit at night, and when we got mortared, I didn't put it on.
Hmm. Why not?
I don't know. I just didn't like it. It was heavy on my head, and I never really thought like it saved me much, so I just didn't ever wear it. I don't even remember anyone telling me to wear it. I never wore it on in a Jeep. Never. I know it sounds crazy when I think about it now, but I just didn't like wearing a helmet. And I think I had to go look for it when I left to make sure I'd have to turn it in down Saigon.
How about your RTO? Did he wear a helmet or not?
I don't think so. Not, no, when we went on a night ambush, we nobody wore helmets. Remember, the yards are wearing loincloths.
Yeah.
And are barefoot. In some cases, some of them may have worn Ho Chi Minh's, but mostly they're barefoot. So, you know, me with a helmet on, and a flat jacket. That's another thing. Never wore a flat jacket. I wore a flak jacket during the siege of Phu Nhon when I knew everything was hitting the fan. I ran across that yard. I'll tell you that later on, but I ran across that yard, and when I got in, my flak jacket was totally filled with shrapnel. So it saved me. The one time I wore it,
wow.
But even after that, I never wore it. I didn't wear it in the Jeep. I should have worn it in the Jeep when we made the trips, but I didn't. I don't know. I it's a good question, but I don't know why I didn't. I never wore on an operation like that. I would wear. I had long pants on. I wore these things that I had made, and I wore jungle boots. I had carried a flashlight with a red cover, but I traveled light on those night operations. In fact, I hardly ever wore a rucksack. I can only remember a couple of operations where I had to wear a rucksack because I thought I would be out long enough, and it was mostly filled with ammunition. So
right.
I was fortunate in the kind of operations that we went out on that they were very short in duration. I was not one of these soldiers that spent 14 days in the boonies before he got to come back in. So I have great respect for the infantry soldiers of the American units who would go out on those kinds of operations. I traveled light.
Do you have a knife or a canteen?
No. I carry a canteen, but I didn't carry a knife, I don't believe. I don't remember having a knife. I had a... No, I don't think I carried a knife.
How do you walk into the jungle? And kind of disappear, I guess, into the jungle, into the bush there, seeking to make contact with someone mm-hmm. who wants to kill you, and I mean, walking out there, not knowing what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. How do you do that?
Well, you try to draw on all that training that you've had about stealth, about quiet. I think what happens to someone like myself as a leader, someone that didn't grow up this way. I'm not a person that was, you know, a hunter. So it didn't come naturally for me. But I think what happens is that you are the leader. And because you're the leader, you're in charge. It would be no different than if I was walked into a boardroom and I had to conduct a meeting. And we had to decide what product we need to get out and how we're going to turn a profit with it. Which, at this time in my life, I hadn't done that either. Later years, I would do that, and as I think back, that's kind of what I compare it to. But at that moment in time, this was my first leadership role. And so, being afraid, yeah, I was. Being scared of knifed, yeah, I was all those things. But I was in charge. And it was on me that the lives of all those men depended. I had to have my stuff together. I had to have my artillery pre-planned. I had to be the one that if there was a contact, I had to be the guy that was that was able to save their lives and create body count in addition to that. So I don't remember thinking, even though I was scared, I remember having enough presence of mind to say, this is your show. You're the one who said, boys, we're going out tonight. You're the one who said, we might get something. You're the one that flew the reconnaissance in the morning and saw some opportunities where maybe this could have taken place last night and maybe they'll be back tonight. You're the one that put the plan together. You better have your shit together.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the most important thing to me. On all those operations, all those night operations, even though when they said, hey, we need somebody to take a night ambush patrol out tonight, who wants to go? I don't ever remember my hand going up first.
Right. I mean, that's almost like a self-preservation thing, you know. I'll do it if asked and I have to.
But and I'll do it well. I mean, yeah. I felt confident that I could perform with all the training that I had had. But I also can remember thinking, gee whiz, maybe something will happen and they'll change their mind.
I thought you said
no, gee whiz. Thinking, maybe he'll change his mind. I was almost always at the direction of the district advisor.
Mm-hmm. The American
district advisor, yeah. Well, by definition, American advisor.
Advisor.
He was pretty, the second one, I had two of them, and the second one was really good in this sense. And he would come in and he'd say, I think we need to do a night ambush because of what happened there. Who wants to do it? He would say that a lot, and he didn't get a lot of volunteers, but it was a matter of, you know, my turn, my time. So I don't ever remember saying being the one that initiated the idea of a night ambush.
Would you guys draw straws? Do you just rotate?
No, I think you just look at each other and say, who did it last? I was the assistant MAT team leader. My captain, he had rank on me. He was a first lieutenant when he got there, and then he made captain, and that's why they gave him the job. And he was a 16-year service, had 16 years in part and 12 of it, I think, or 13 of it as an enlisted man. But he had no combat experience. When he came in, I had already earned my CID. I'd already been in several contacts. I'd been ambushed on the highway. I'd already been out and been ambushed in the field. So I had a lot of combat experience. He had none. And actually, by the end of the tour, by the end of my tour, he still had less combat experience than I had had. Only because his all came at the end of my tour, which was sort of the middle of his tour.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny how you think about situations like that. You've been in combat. By the time I was going on these night patrols, night ambush patrols, but I'd had, I don't know, my short timers chart, I used to mark every time I was in an enemy contact. I had little codes for big contact, small contact, stuff like this, and I'd put a little square around it. And I think the other day we were going through and I had 25 or something, of varying degrees. And I think you almost feel like you're getting good at it. You're not overconfident exactly, but you think you're better at it than he is. So he was my boss, and I can remember sort of feeling like, well, he's in charge, but he's not as good at what I'm doing at this moment as I am. So I may have volunteered in that sense. I may have said, no, I'll take it, Pete. I'll do it. I've done this before.
Mm-hmm.
I may have done that. But it was never done in a sense of, I don't ever remember thinking that I should do it because this will help win the war. Or I should do it because, after all, that's what they're paying me to do. I was always reluctant, but it might have been that if I'd been too reluctant, then somebody else would have had to done it and maybe wouldn't be as good at it as I am because mm-hmm. I'd been through it before.
Right. Did you ever say, hey, why don't you come out with me and I'll kind of show you?
No, because a lieutenant and a captain, both out, you'd never do that. In fact, we didn't even ride in the same jeeps. We even had we each had our own jeeps. And we very seldom, I don't ever remember being out on any operation with him. The only time we were ever in combat together was the night that the compound was overrun in March of 15th and 16th of 71. And we were all in it that night, and that was, I think, probably when he got his most of his combat experience was that night. And for a lot of us, it was the worst we were ever in, but it wasn't the first. So I think, but to have real mixed emotions, I never went out on operation hoping for contact. Even though that's what you're there for, I don't ever remember thinking, oh boy, I hope tonight's the night we get to kill somebody. I don't ever remember thinking that. But I do remember thinking that that's what we're trained to do. If they say do it, we'll go do it. Kind of like the whole thing of being there in the first place. Mm-hmm. They told me to go. I'm trained to do it. I'll go do it. But I don't ever remember being the first to volunteer for anything.
Do you write an extra letter that day or a letter that day before you go out and say...
We had... you mean to my wife?
Yeah.
We had this deal where we would write... all of us, most of the guys, we'd write several letters and date them. Like I'd sit down on Sunday afternoon, because we literally would try to take Saturday afternoons and all day Sunday off. We were in a compound. It was kind of stand down time. And we always wore civilian clothes that day, and even if we pulled guard duty, we pulled it in cutoffs. Or if we went out in the highway, even if a village down south got hit, I threw on my magazine vest and grabbed my Car 15, and I went in my shorts because it was Sunday. It was just part of maintaining some kind of normalcy. Mm-hmm. That it's weekend. So on Sunday afternoons, a lot of times, I had this thing with my wife where I would try to write her so she could get a letter every day. And so on Sunday afternoon, I might sit down and write five letters. And one would be Mondays, one would be Tuesdays, one would be Wednesdays. You know, you're just saying the same thing all the time. You know, I love you very much. You're very seldom saying what happened. So what difference does it make what you call? It's just something to open on the other end.
Sure.
Although, as I've read these letters in recent, I'm still amazed that I said as many things as I did to her about the war. That I don't remember doing, but I apparently did. But what I would do is we'd always tell the guys that if I'm not here tomorrow, if I'm killed, mail the letter anyway when the chopper comes in, because the choppers would come in to resupply us virtually every day. We would get mail, we would get food, we would get movies from Saigon, 16mm movies. So you'd tell them to put a letter on there, put Tuesdays on there, and you just leave it on your desk. In your little desk in our hoots there, and so I did that, and so I had all these letters kind of stacked up, and the instructions to the guys. Well, when we had our big siege in 71, choppers couldn't get in, and we were being resupplied with ammunition only, and they weren't taking mail and all that kind of stuff. So she didn't get a letter for a week. And even though the letters were written. So now when I read the letters, she's got all these letters written every day during the siege. I mean, but she didn't get them, you know? And so it's like, whoa. So I had to swing to that. No, I don't think preeminence, if you're trying to get to preeminent, where you're thinking that you might die and stuff like that, I think after a while you just think that it might come any time. It could come from a mortar. It could come from a landmine on the highway. I could say the landmines were my bigger fear. I worried more about going in to play coup to the PX to get beer going in for meetings. But usually, if it was a meeting, they'd fly us in. But we did some really stupid and crazy things about, you know, we would make runs to the PX or we'd make runs to the Air Force Base there in Pleiku because they had all the good food, and we would trade them. We'd get these Mountain Yard crossbows guys would make for us, and we'd take them in and trade them for a case of steaks. We pretty much get all the beer and booze we wanted, but steaks were hard to get. Mm-hmm. And so we'd trade things for them, and we'd make the runs. And I was an officer, but I'd make the run. I would never drive. I very seldom drove because I had my own Jeep, and I was a pretty good driver, but I didn't even learn to drive a stick shift till I got to Vietnam. So I wasn't the kind of person who feels real comfortable driving a Jeep in combat. So I usually pulled rank and would ride shotgun. And truly in combat, when you ride shotgun, you're riding shotgun.
Right. Right.
You have a gun on your lap. And then then I'd usually have someone drive. I was ambushed so many times. I don't even know how many times. It just happened. Seems like every time we went to Pleiku, we got ambushed.
On the road.
On the road. Ambushed. Oh, yeah. We got shot at. We had a B-40 rocket hit. In fact, I wasn't driving then either. I was trying to think if I was ever driving when we got ambushed, and I don't think we ever were. We got ambushed one time when a B-40 rocket, or an RPG, mm-hmm, fired from a B-40, hit the windshield on my side. Like, I'm here, and it hit the windshield and didn't explode. It just fell off to the side of the road.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. I mean, stuff like that, it was such a common occurrence that we would get ambushed that we didn't even ever think we weren't going to be ambushed. We would just go.
And of course, you wouldn't wear your helmet. Mm-hmm. You just would take off. You'd have your M1 or your M14.
I had an M1 carbine sometimes, but and I remember, I think the M1 carbine, I think I carried that in the beginning of my tour because it was neat. It was cool. The guys, and I bought it from somebody for $10 or something. And then I think after one of the ambushes, I decided that wasn't real smart, and because you had to throw that switch, and it was, you know, it was a World War II weapon.
Right.
So it didn't have nearly the firepower. You couldn't get enough out there, and that's all you care about in an ambush. All you care about in an ambush in a vehicle is firing your weapon enough to get their heads down so that they're not accurate coming back at you. That's all you care about. You know, you're hitting anything, you don't want to. You just want to start putting it out there. And you can't do that with an M1 very well. So I think I started carrying that Car-15 after the first couple of times of ambush. The guys kind of said, hey, this, you know, you better. We also had on one of our Jeeps, we had an M60 mounted on a tripod as the back thing. And then on one of them, we had a 50 cal.
Helps.
Yeah, it does. And then we had, of course, sandbags on top of all that. Sandbags in the bottom of the Jeep to keep mines. And you can hit a Jeep, and you can hit an anti-personnel mine with a Jeep. And if you have sandbags, you will be protected. Your feet will be protected. If you hit an anti-tank mine, you won't be. And we knew that. And so we were always scared. But we would try to get the engineers out first. We had an engineering battalion down the highway that the intersection in Metauk where the M14 went off here. And their job was to patrol M14 every morning. I mean, Highway 14 every morning for landmines. And they had a minesweeping operation. And if we could, and then we'd always go behind that. And it seems like every time we didn't do that, if somebody went out early, then we'd have problems. And we had Lumbrettas blown up by landmines and 20 people dead kind of thing. It was really sad. That was the worst fear for me, was a landmine. Mm-hmm. Just terrible. Just the destruction of... I saw a deuce and a half, an American deuce and a half, an engine prevalent. In fact, I think it was the first American I ever saw killed. I saw an anti-tank mine come up from through the bottom of a deuce and a half and kill the driver and just cut him in half. The anti-tank mines were just terrible. That was my worst fear. Mm. So.
We need to stop time-wise. Thanks, Ron. We'll pick up again.
Okay.